Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. Listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Obama's being put on the couch, and I'm going to ask, how bad is Obama's woman problem? Not does he have a woman problem, because he does, but I'm going to ask, how bad is Obama's woman problem? Why am I doing this? Because it's true. Barack Obama compared Sarah Palin to a pig with lipstick. There is no question about it. But we have to ask ourselves, what exactly is Obama's problem with women? To find the answer, we must return to Obama's childhood and examine his relationship with his mother. In 1961, Obama's mother, Ann Dunham, married Obama's father, a man from Kenya. The man from Kenya soon abandoned the family. Within 3 years, they were divorced. In 1967, his mother married another man, this time an Indonesian. A few years later, she was divorced again. Through all this time, Obama's mother went globetrotting from Hawaii to Indonesia to Pakistan. Sometimes she took her young son with her. Sometimes he was left behind. What appears to have happened to Obama as a result is he developed symptoms of what psychologists refer to as an Oedipal complex in Freudian terms. In an Oedipal complex, a male child is fixated on his mother and competes with his father for maternal attention. I want to repeat this for many of you because Freud, although is no longer popular, he was a towering giant compared to the Lilliputians in psychology today. And much of what Freud wrote will eventually rise again back to the towering genius that it was, while the Lilliputians of today who debunk him and say that behavioral psychology or drugs are all you really need will be forgotten. So let me repeat again. I think in analyzing this as an amateur psychologist, that Obama has developed a very serious Oedipal complex. Again, I will repeat that. In an Oedipal complex, according to Freud, a male child is fixated on his mother and competes with his father for maternal attention. In such cases, a critical point of awakening occurs where the child realizes that the mother has affections for others besides himself. In this case, Obama had to compete with multiple paternal stand-ins and was never fully able to bond with his mother. The result seems to have been a resentment towards women that he has never been able to get beyond. Furthermore, excessive separation within an Oedipal complex often leads to a sense of helplessness that can in turn lead to patterns of idealized control and self-sufficiency. Did you hear what I just said? This complex often leads to patterns of idealized control and self-sufficiency, which I think shines through in his often arrogant smile. Now, Obama's mother sent him to live away from her when he was 10. And again, he was sent away when he was 14. It seems clear that this excessive separation in the absence of a father has led to a pattern of idealized control that Obama has not only imposed on himself, but now wants to impose on the United States of America. Obama's mother was a free spirit who traipsed around the world following her own self-interests. And while there's nothing wrong with that in itself, you cannot ignore the effects that such narcissism has had on her children, especially when one of those children wants to be the president of the United States of America. It seems Obama has a woman problem. He wants both to win their approval and control them at the same time. Unfortunately for him, Sarah Palin is not the kind of woman who responds well to control. Millions of women like Sarah may be traditional in their love for men, but they are feminists in terms of self-reliance. Attacking such strong women in an attempt to control them has never worked and will not work for Obama. I'm Michael Savage, and I approve. Do you think Obama has a woman problem, as evidenced by lipstick on a pig? Do you think he has an Oedipal complex? And therapists in particular, those of you who are traditional therapists, if you agree with me that he has an Oedipal complex, how bad a complex is it on a scale of 1 to 10? What do you think Obama's Oedipal complex would rate? 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I would especially welcome calls from real psychologists and psychiatrists who understand the context in which this is presented. This is the Savage Nation. The phone number here is 1-800-449-8255. Houston, Texas. Scott, go ahead. You're up on the Savage Nation.
Afternoon, Doc. Pleasure to talk to you. I am a psychiatrist, and I deal with the Oedipus complex both with children and with adults. And a trend that happens in the adult side of someone who cannot shake it is the female counterpart, in this case we're going to look at his wife, actually becomes shelter for the now adult male. So he's found that love, he's found that attraction, he has that wife, but
yes,
she is more the controlling part of him. And of course we're not going to see it because it's Obama on the stage, not his wife for the most part. But,
right. So, but Michelle is more or less a mother figure for him, you know, as is true in many marriages, not just in his marriage. But, you know, you are a psychiatrist, probably a little older on the order of someone who grew up in Freudian, studying Freudian psychiatry. Am I right?
Actually, I'm 32 years old.
Oh, you got me full there, because the younger guys don't believe that Freud has any validity.
The younger guys don't read enough. Unfortunately, I grew up in a generation that's incredibly lazy and is phased out by video games and Cleveland Notes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I'm saying you are a psychiatrist in the sense of, are you an MD psychiatrist?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so you're the real McCoy, as opposed to the overnight degrees from shady little colleges where they practice family therapy and things of that nature and tell everybody that they're gay, and to simply leave their husband or wife and follow their inner gayness. That seems to be the be-all and end-all. If only you follow your inner gayness, you'll be perfectly happy for the rest of your years. But getting back to the seriousness of this discussion, do you believe that I am onto something here with my analysis of Obama with regard to the Oedipal complex?
Absolutely, because, I mean, it does exist. Like I said, there is a trend that can exist throughout the lifetime of a male human being, and what happens is they find a steady female in their life, and it can be a best friend, it can be a wife, which is what I'm going to use in this situation, and that becomes the center of the world. That becomes the yes. The
well,
no.
Let's go back to Bill Clinton for a minute. This is an interesting discussion now. Bill Clinton, didn't he have an issue with a mother who had a sort of clouded past?
You know, I'm not...
Well, let's put that one aside. Let's say a man has a mother who is unreliable emotionally to him. Let's put it in a more broad context. That kind of man can go many different directions, obviously. The human condition is unlimited in what it can produce. But very often, that type of relationship between a mother who's flirty, flighty, multiple partners in cases, I'm not reflecting Obama here or Clinton... That type of guy can seek security through a steady relationship with a woman and then cheat on that woman for the rest of his life in order to, in some ways, get even with his mother who was cheating on him.
Absolutely. That person is going to mimic and mirror a lot of those things that he saw in his mother. His mother being a role model, having multiple partners and things of that nature, he's going to mimic that throughout his life.
Now, we then get to the next issue of several allegiances. Now, this is very intriguing. Obama seems to be breaking apart and making some mistakes, and I think that we're seeing parts of him that he's had very well controlled until now, Scott. Do you agree with that analysis?
Oh, absolutely, and he's flipped up, you know, several times, but the media hasn't blown it up. I remember he made one comment in regards to if one of my daughters got pregnant and made that mistake at a young age, and he was speaking in regards of abortion, and he used the words mistake and things of that nature. He has slipped up. He's made several slip-ups, but of course no one's going to hound in on it, and no one's going to pay attention to it.
Well, that's why we're putting Obama on the couch, and I conclude that I think he has a woman problem. I don't know the degree to which this Oedipal complex is operational, but I think his slip of the tongue with the lipstick on a pig comment indicates a contempt for women that has already backfired on him, and all the king's horses and all the king's men will not put Obama together again. Thank you for the call. This is the Savage Nation. As usual, the unusual. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Tennessee, J.D., you're on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind, my friend?
Hey, Mike, long time, man. I've been listening to you for I don't know how long. Can never get through because you're the hardest working man in show business. But
love it, love it, love it. But, what made you call? What made you call tonight?
One Arm Frank is the number one stunner in your book, man. I was in the military and I had a guy that I knew, man, and his breath was so stinking, man. I'm talking about his car smelled like his breath. The interior in his car smelled like his breath. Even in the cold, we was trying to ride with him in his car. My car broke down. We had to let the windows down in his car.
And wait a minute. You're not saying he had one arm, are you?
You couldn't take it. And when you roll the windows up, it's like it was embedded in his interior. Everything. Man, you could smell him 10 feet away from him. That's how bad.
But I want to ask you something. I'm not being cruel in any way. Did he have one arm?
No, sir. No, sir. But I'll never forget the guy. This guy was from North.
No, but he had a breath on him that I say was a medicinal problem. Like you had to go to a specialist to cure this.
I don't know what, Mike, but his breath smelled like a sewer. It smelled like a bad.
Well, J.D., did you get the book yet? J.D., can you hear me? Did you get a copy of the book yet?
No, sir. That's reading.
Well, you're going to... Hold it. Don't go away. Stay on the line. I'm sending you a free copy, but I want to read you and ask you if this is what you're talking about. I said, in those days... So One Arm Frank was a very sweet guy, but he had sick breath. Now, I want to tell you, there are bad breaths, and then there are very bad breaths, and then there are medicinal problems. This one had to be solved with a medicine that hasn't been invented yet. I remember one winter my old man was dropping Frank off at his home. Frank was in the passenger seat, and I sat in the back. It was -4 degrees out, but we had arrived with all the windows open. Did you ever meet a person like this? Whenever he spoke, the car filled with a nauseous fume. Are we going past the meat factory? No. Did we run over a small furry creature that got caught in the muffler and the smell shot up through the floorboard? Did I step on something? Nope. I mean, I took my shoes off. No, but it was only Frank talking. Okay, J.D., no, don't go away. I'm sending you a free copy of Psychological Nudity. Everybody loves that story. They don't understand that those, because I think that was before mouthwashes. J.D., that's another interesting side story here. In my father's generation, a man would not use a mouthwash or a deodorant. You know that.
Yes, sir.
If a guy used an underarm deodorant in my father's day and a mouthwash, you know that they felt he belonged in San Francisco.
Man, you're the best, Mike. You're number one in the nation.
No, I mean, if they caught a guy and they went in his bathroom, let's say they had to use the John, and they saw a roll-on deodorant and a mouthwash, they never talked to him again.
Man, I haven't seen this guy in years, but I'll never forget him because of his breath. Man, I've never smelled the first
mouth. Hey, J.D., let me ask you something. Are you a musician by any chance?
No, sir. But I do.
Well, you sure have a musician's sense of humor. I got to tell you that. J.D., a free copy, Psychological Nudity, going out to you in Tennessee because you made me feel so good and laugh so hard. I got to tell you, that's a great call. That is a great call. You see, we can transcend politics, race, generations, all with what? The miracle of humor, the miracle of communication. It is a miracle. It's a miracle, and I'm gifted. I know it's a gift. It goes back, again, not to dwell on the past, but how did it start? And this is not in the new book, but it should be. Because it's a very important story. I've told it once in 15 years. First grade, New York inner city school, play, auditorium. Now, I don't know if you know, there are some people who are terrified to give a speech in front of them. These could be tough guys, tough kids, murder, tough as nails. You put them in front of an audience, their face turns red. They can't say a word. They can't say anything. It's a gift. If you can do it, it's a gift, okay? It doesn't make you better than the other guy. It happens to be a thing you have. It's like another guy can run, jump, throw a basketball, whatever, fly a plane. But talking in front of an audience, so I didn't know I could do it. How do you know if you could do it? You have no idea. But although we were poor, my mother wanted me to look good, so she bought me a little blue suit. It was probably $9. This was before Dead Man's Pants, when we had less money. She bought me an actual suit that fit in my size. It was probably in Barney's Boys Town, wherever she saved money. So I had a little blue suit. So the teacher said to me, look, you're the only kid in the whole school with a suit. I said, I don't know. So she's, get the suit, bring it in, you're going to be the announcer for the assembly. I got up, I saw a sea of people, and I wasn't frightened. I enjoyed it. I liked it. It was like a sea of faces. It was, look, it's an interesting thing looking at an audience if you don't panic. It just looks like a sea, like a little waves chopping around in there. They don't look like people to you at that point. Anyway, I learned that I could talk to an audience, and that's how it started. That's all it was to it. And it was a gift that I had at that time, and that's all there was to it. Now I'm going to move up one grade, two grade, three grade, four grade. Now I was a short kid, and I had gone to school early, then I skipped a grade. So I was younger and smaller than most of the kids. So if I'm in elementary school, and it goes up to the eighth grade in those days, there was no junior high. It was like 1 through 8, then high school, 9 through 12. There was no intermediary school where you learned how to have, you know, sex, whatever. In other words, it was right into the 8th grade. Now, picture this. So in this school of 1 through 8, K through 8, it was 1 through 8. There was no K. The K, you were home already with the grandmother who didn't speak English in kindergarten. There was no such thing as kindergarten because the mothers didn't work. You sat around and you watched them make Jell-O or whatever. So 1 through 8, you had kids now 5 years old in the first grade. And in the eighth grade, you might have a dummy who was also left back because of truancy and bad behavior who might be 15. So you had kids ranging in age from 5 to 15 in the same school. Now picture me. I go in the bathroom. I'm in the fourth, fifth grade, and I have to go to the men's room. This was like, it was like terror, blackboard jungle. There were no monitors. There were no cops, no nothing. You might have a 14, 15-year-old like giant maniac in that bathroom, and you're this little kid who's got to go in there and do your thing. So I had to figure out how to go in there and come out with, like, not being killed. So I found out that I'd go in, and right away I'd arrest the guys. They were usually slower. Okay, admittedly, they might have been violent, but they were slow with it. So you had to, like, charm them rapidly. So I'd go in, a short little kid, younger. I have to use the bathroom. How do I get out of this terrible thing? I still have nightmares to this day. I don't like public bathrooms. I hate them. Really, it goes back to that trauma. Go in, look the big guy in right in the eye. I'm not going to threaten him. He'd kill me. I'd tell him a joke. I'd look right in the eye and point at him and say, hey, listen. Savvy.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
We're playing Hawaiian music because, first of all, I'd like to be there right now, truthfully. But I'm going to wait it out. Great place. It's a great place. Great. I lived there for a number of years, you know. You know what it's like for a kid from New York to go, like, to wind up in Hawaii? I'd never been in a place like that. It was unbelievable. It was like walking into, heaven itself. So anyway, to make a long story short, we're talking about a turn-it-off now, a long time ago. You know, when you land in heaven, you think you can do anything. And you have hubris. Hubris is a sense of confidence that only children in the mad have and can understand. But when a grown-up has hubris, it becomes very dangerous. And in my case, that was true. So you get to the islands, and it's a magical time. You never saw sunsets like this. They can break your heart. When you see plumeria blossoms lying on the, you know, I used to bicycle up to the university. I would see plumeria blossoms lying on the sidewalk. I would stop the bicycle and pick up the plumeria blossoms and look at them and smell them. And I'd never seen anything like this. Sure, I had seen rose petals on the fence in the Bronx when I was a little kid. They were soft and beautiful, but this was something unique. The scent was unlike anything I had ever experienced. And so you see these sunsets and these sunrises and all of these things that you had never seen, and birds in the jungles in the back of the rainforest that you never saw or heard before. And you start to get tuned into your own body in a way you've never been tuned in. If you've never lived in the tropics and it's the first time, and you start shedding clothing and shoes and leather, and you put it all away, and now you're in flip-flops, and then you're in shorts, and all of a sudden at night the breeze comes through your sleeves, and you start to become alive in a new way, and you go in the warm water. So you start to feel like the original man, and you buy a sailboat. It's the first thing you do. And so I bought a sloop-rigged boat. She was not catch-rigged, I was mistaken. I remember now, Tirangi was a sloop-rigged sailing vessel about 22 feet long, and it was made of white oak primarily, and it was, had been built in Oregon and sailed out by somebody else to Hawaii. I bought it for nothing, you know, next to nothing. She was in perfect shape and no engine, as I said. So I buy this boat. I put it into the Alawai Yacht Harbor, and that's where I kept it. And, you know, most people who own boats mainly use them to drink on and hang out, and it's as good a thing to do as any. But I was foolish enough to actually want to sail the boat, even though I knew nothing about sailing. And I took it out without an engine. I knew it was pretty easy to get out because the wind was prevailing out of the yacht harbor. And I said, wow, this is great. And so I, you know, with a few friends, I was on a boat alone. They just cast me off, released the lines, pushed me backwards, and there we go, down the Alawai Channel, out into the channel and out into the ocean. I was zipping along with the sail out, and I was zipping along out onto sea, and there I was. I said, this is super. I'm really enjoying myself. Then I realized I didn't know how to get back. I said, how do I turn this thing around if the wind is blowing out? Well, I didn't know how. And I said, well, I better figure this out, because if this keeps up for a while, I'll soon be out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and there'll be no way back at all. I had no flares, no radio, no engine. All I had was confidence that was bordering on the insane. So the first thing I did was I resorted to common sense, and I dropped the sails, because that, of course, would cut the motion of the boat. I dropped the sails, and using the tiller, I turned the boat around, you know, flip-flop, flip-flop, until I got the boat pointing back towards the land. And then I figured if the wind is blowing against me, there must be a way to go into a prevailing wind and still move against it. I've seen other people do it. And little by little, and lo and behold, I was able to, luckily, I don't know whether it was current or God's hand itself pushed me back into the harbor, but I learned quickly that sailing is not for the amateur. That's all there was to it. So those days are over. But she was my first boat. I don't have a life ring from Tirangi because I didn't even have a life ring. I don't even think I had a life preserver. You know, those were the age. That was an age when people had total, like, madness about what they could do and accomplish in the late 60s. But now I drive a power boat, and it has all sorts of safety equipment on it. Sure, not enough as I should have. But I like power boats a lot better because they're easier to get out. I can get this thing out of the way. It's 45 feet, twin diesels, 19 tons, unladen with fuel and water, and I can go out on it alone and come back on it alone in almost any wind. And that's the good part. You can get out in 12, 15 minutes, and there it is. It's just you and the birds and the water and the land, and that's it. And that's what I go out for now, is just to look at the water and look at the birds and look at the landforms, mainly, and the seals I like. And I can name every bird on the bay. More or less, I know every bird on the bay as a species. Not by name, not like, how you doing, howdy. I don't mean that. Species-wise, I've come to understand that every animal has a personality. Isn't this strange? It's not that the PETA folks are correct. I still eat animals. But they all have a personality when you get to know them. And they all want to live. Dad taught me that everything wants to live. That's how he taught me to respect human life. He said, you'll notice that a cat wants to live, a dog wants to live, a rat wants to live, a mouse wants to live, a bird wants to live. And he had learned that when he had accidentally shot a bird as a kid. Remember, this is odd to a country boy listening to the show. It sounds very weak. But remember, I'm a New York City boy. And to us, it's a different experience than it is to you guys. I respect your ability to hunt for your food. But every animal actually has a personality when you get to know that animal. They're all different. Just as we're all different, every human is unique and like a snowflake. Well, guess what? So are animals. They're all unique. It's amazing when you come to understand that. A story from the New York Post. It's rather trivial, but it leads to another question. And that is, it's a countess from Sweden, 32 years old. She marries a 65-year-old American rich man, CEO of United Technologies, 66 years old. She's now 36. Now they're at a divorce trial, and they were accusing each other. And they claim that there was this and that, sleeping with each other. Now the lawyer's saying, did you sleep with her after you broke up? Because if you did, if you had sex, it means the post-nup has no validity. So he says, yes, we slept together, but there was no sex. You hear this? So no matter what these women get, I mean, she's already going to get, I think, $36 million no matter what happens. If the judge believes they reconciled, he may toss out an 05 post-nup, granting her immediately 600,000 shares of United Technology stock, currently worth $36 million. If the judge throws that out, this gold digger will grab more of this man's $329 million fortune, all for a little sex. You know, and this leads me to the conclusion that the post-nup always rings twice. And with the lawyers today, of course, the post-nup does always ring twice. But it leads me to another question about post-nups and prenups. And I'd like to ask you out there, I'm going to get off politics for a minute, although it's very political. Is there anyone listening to the show who has a pre- or post-nup horror story that you'd like to share with us here on the Savage Nation? The husband's side contends that the post-nup is rock solid and that she's being greedy and grabbing for any more of his hard-earned $321 million fortune. She always wants more, 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 complained the man's lawyer. Too much is never enough. In other words, she's a you-know-what. We won't even use the word. Los Angeles, KGIL country. Mark, welcome to the Savage Nation.
I was definitely taken advantage of with a prenup agreement. I signed the agreement with my wife, who had never earned a dime in her life before I married her. I was a stockbroker, and my commissions were approximately $1 million a year. However, I only got to keep about 45% of that.
Right.
And my agreement with her was that she would get about $100,000 a year afterwards if we got divorced. Well,
right.
Her attorney decided to value my business. They multiplied my $1 million a year total commissions times 20 years and said my business was worth $20 million and awarded her $10 million.
Well, wait, they never heard of income taxes in Los Angeles courts?
They didn't understand it. The attorneys didn't understand it. The judges didn't understand it. I was making 400 and some thousand a year, not $1 million.
So she was awarded $10 million, and did you actually have to pay it?
Well, unfortunately, I settled with her, and I got around it. I took advantage of it because I was supposed to give her a Mercedes, and I gave her my pension account, which she had to pay tax on everything she took out of it.
Good. I only hope that she suffered.
Well, the Mercedes, I took a loan against the house and bought the car.
I would have given her a Mercedes with a blown crankshaft, and a wheel should have fallen off on Highway 1.
She never made more than $10,000 in her life.
And where is she today? What, she become a lesbian?
No, she's single, living well.
Terrible. No, it's a horrible story what they do to men today in these courts. Horrible. A nightmare. But you're still laughing. I can tell you that something tells me you're still having a good time, Mark.
Well, I'm doing okay.
We don't want to know about it. Why is it that sex is so expensive in America? In other words, the guy falls in love. He sees stars in his eyes. It's only good for 90 days, that passionate hot sex, Mark. You know that.
I know that. No one has sex with their wife.
Well, no, 90 days is the maximum. 90, 91 days. It's been studied. This has been studied inside and out. 90 days of great sex, and that's about it. After that, the rest is a nightmare.
100% agreement with you.
Hey, before you go, Mark, because you're so good-natured, remember, were you listening to the time I told the story? I was in Newport, I think last spring, and I walked into a bar like the Rusty whatever, and there was this huge guy like a Hell's Angel in there with a T-shirt on, and the back of his T-shirt, he was laughing with his friends. He had a slogan on the back, and it said, "It's better to have loved and lost, ... than to have been married to a psychotic you-know-what for 38 years. We are moving away from human reproduction. We are moving into government control of the production of human beings. As you well know, Obama is a dictator in the making. He's an embryonic dictator. And this embryo of a dictator, if he is not stopped, if this embryo of a dictator is not resisted, if there is no resistance to this embryonic dictator that we have, my friends, anything is possible. No one man should be permitted to have passed 17 executive orders in less than 2 months. And yet that has happened right in front of your eyes. And so this most dangerous radical college professor has bypassed Congress, bypassed the people. He's telling you that you wanted the Brave New World when nobody asked you what you wanted. But the fact of the matter is that Obama's policy is not moderate at all. It is not a moderate policy. According to the article in Wall Street Journal, it will promote a whole new industry of creating and destroying embryos. It will include the creation of human embryos by cloning for research in which they are destroyed. And it forces American taxpayers like you, who see the deliberate taking of human life in the embryonic stage as unjust, to be complicit in this murder. Obama made a big point in his speech of claiming to bring integrity back to science policy. And he said he wanted to remove the previous administration's ideological agenda from scientific decision-making. I agree with the authors that this claim of taking science out of politics is both false and misguided. First of all, the Obama policy itself is radical, leftist, and political. It is red meat to his Bush-bashing, Bush-hating, Republican-hating base, and yet pays no more than lip service to the new science, the new breakthroughs in science that we discussed yesterday that makes possible the production of cells that are biologically equivalent to embryonic stem cells without the need to kill or create human embryos. In other words, from adults. And I want to pause here again for those of you who don't have science background. It's okay, you don't need to. What are we talking about when we say stem cell research? What is a stem? Think of a stem on a tree. From a stem grows a branch. From a branch grows the leaf and the fruit. It's the same with human cells. You start with a stem cell, in essence, really an embryonic cell. It's not really an embryonic cell, it's just an early cell. And from let's say you have nerve damage and you want to repair this nerve damage. What you would try to do is get a stem cell and encourage it through scientific methods to grow additional cells, additional nerve cells, which then can be used to restore your damaged nervous system area, okay? But you don't need to do this from embryos. This can be done from adult cells. Obama knows this, yet Obama is a deceptive pretender. Obama is a radical Marxist by every definition. Now, I've been calling him a neo-Nazi, what he's been doing. I won't be the last. I'm only going to be the first, as usual, in defining what this president is. I am always ahead of the curve. I am warning you that you're being dragged down an unbrave new world and you'll regret it in the future. The fact of the matter is, Obama revoked not only the Bush restrictions on embryo killing research funding, but he also revoked the 07 executive order that encourages the NIH to explore non-embryo destructive sources of stem cells. You understand that? In other words, it was a very political claim. And getting to that point, his claim about taking politics out of science is not only a lie, but it's anti-democratic. You see, the question of whether to destroy human embryos for research purpose is not really a scientific question, is it? It is a moral and civic question about the limits of science, the uses of science, the ambitions of science. And as I described, we understand what happens when science is not controlled by a government. And that can lead to a human experimentation. Mengele, the mad Nazi doctor, used living Jews to experiment upon. The real issue here is how we're going to treat members of the human family at the very dawn of life. Are there not alternative paths to medical progress that respect human dignity? Of course there are. You understand this? And so, ladies and gentlemen of the Savage Nation, I believe in democracy. But if we want to destroy and mistreat the most vulnerable human lives, we are doing so at our own moral peril. And for Obama to say that we are taking politics out of science is a very, very sad, sad statement indeed. Now, this stem cell debate is going to continue, not only on this show, but throughout America. It has not been continued on CNN. It has not been continued on ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox News, more snotty nonsense by chicks. It's a done deal to these anti-democratic forces of the media. And they don't even understand what they have done here. They have no idea. Father, forgive them, for they do not know how they have sinned. They have no idea how they have sinned. But I have a moral obligation on this radio show, don't I, to use the gift not only of my minor, fleeting fame and importance in radio and in thinking in America. And I repeat, minor, fleeting fame, because that is what God has given me. Minor, fleeting fame is not to be used for my own aggrandizement, but to do God's will and God's work on this earth. You don't have to believe me whether I'm sincere or not. It doesn't matter whether you do or not. I don't care whether you think I'm the most cynical manipulator on earth. It doesn't matter to me. I go to sleep at night, and I sleep soundly. I'm not a perfect person. I'm far from it. I'm as flawed as the next man, if not more so. However, when it comes to this radio show is the most sacred part of my life. I know that this accident called talk radio, meaning my entering talk radio 15 years ago, this accident that saved my professional life from the fires of unemployment, the fires of hell itself, caused by the liberal social engineers who wanted to put me on the dustbin of history. This was not an accident. I'm not in front of you by accident. I'm here for a reason and for a purpose. I got to tell you something, people listening to the show. I want to thank you again. I mean, I don't do this enough. It is about me. And you have to be an egomaniac to do talk radio well. Let's be clear about it. In order to get up here on this stage every day and talk and have the guts to do it and say what you believe and take the heat, take the laughs, take the pratfalls, you have to have an awesome ego. And I got to tell you something. God knows I was blessed with that. But there has to be more to it than just that, or it wouldn't go on very long. There's a lot of people with big egos who are schmucks. They have no substance, no brains, no education, nothing to offer whatsoever. They're not even good enough to be a nightclub comedian. Maybe they'll work for Obama. But, I want to thank you for being such a loyal, loyal audience for 15 years. I didn't do this last week. I didn't thank you enough. Maybe I said it in passing. I know you listen for you, not for me. And that's understandable. We live in such a horrible world that when a light appears somewhere out there that is so remarkably different and is so bright, and you understand immediately that I am telling you the truth and I am giving you the emphasis on what's going on in this country and how evil it all really is. And I again want to thank you from the absolute bottom of my being for listening to The Savage Nation.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. Listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
San Francisco, get some Cuban music ready. Indira, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Aloha, or shall I say, buenos dias.
How are you? Buenos dias.
Buenos dias. What's on your mind today?
Thank you for your good comments about Cubans. We have been here 4 years. We love America. We came with the American dream. We hate these Obama maniacs. We hate liberals. We are.
That's right. Tell me what it is about Obama that makes you very nervous in the Cuban community.
You know, I'm very upset because this guy is Marxist. This guy is communist. It's the same rhetoric, the same speeches, the same dreaming words that everybody, I don't know what happened with the people in America.
In other words, he reminds you of the Castro brothers.
Oh, yeah, the Castro brothers, all the communist youth in Cuba. It's crazy.
He's an absolute Marxist. His rhetoric is Marxist. His actions are Marxist. Seizing banks, seizing auto companies is absolutely Marxist. We are watching Marxism emerge in America, and the dummies in the media say, oh, no, it's not happening.
I'm very disappointed with that because I'm meeting Americans that are not the...
But, you know, Indira, I don't want to cut you off, but my other point, I want to stay positive today. I'm in a positive mood. I was making a slightly different point, which is this. Many Cubans came over, about 130,000, in the Mariel boat time, 1980, and 99.9% of them were people like you, your parents perhaps, who were business owners, property owners. They left because the Obama of Cuba, Castro, seized their businesses, seized their houses, nationalized businesses, and they fled to America for a life of freedom. And what Castro did was he released thousands of criminals and perverts from the jails in order to twist the American mind into thinking that all the Cubans who came in the Mariel boat lift were criminals. And the American media, which was largely socialist and today is largely socialist / Marxist, picked up on that. And they lied to the people, making them all look like Al Pacino and Scarface. Play some Cuban music right now, okay? See, when we say Cuban music, we don't play Desi Arnaz. We know the difference here, at least I do. I know everything about everything. Down to even good music. Who's going to know Cuban music today in talk radio? Rush Limbaugh. Get Guy Lombardo if you ask them to play Cuban music. All right, then a one, then a two. All right, leave Rush alone. He's got enough trouble. I like Rush. Actually, out of all of them, I like him the best. Never met him. I've nothing to say against the guy. Levanta. Hey, do you got any Sonora Matancera? That's what I really want to hear. This is Sonora. Okay, hold it. Let's stop for a minute. Most of my audience doesn't know what we're doing. We're talking about this and that. I'm having some fun. I'm into the Cuban thing today because I'm trying to deconstruct a lie about the Mariel boat lift only because we now have Castro brothers running America in the form of Obama, who's lying to the people through his teeth. And I see it, the Cubans see it, immigrants from Eastern Europe see it, but the dumb American sees nothing, knows nothing, like an idiot walks around, great Obama. But it's. I want to tell you something on a positive note. I got a call the other day from somebody, who remained anonymous, who said that a lot of the white guys in the brokerage business who voted for Obama are so angry at themselves that they realize who he is, that they were duped. You don't understand that millions of people who never would have voted for Obama had the Republicans not run that moron McCain. They went to Obama because they knew McCain was more of the same jerk that we had in Bush, the same Republican machine. So they said, no more. We'll vote for anybody but him. That's what it was. It was a protest vote. But many of them realized what they did now. And so if that election were reheld today, Obama would lose by 20 points. I'll tell you right now. But that's not going to happen. The question is, will we have another election in 4 years? That's up for grabs. Now, let's get back to the music here on the Savage Nation. I'm not a DJ. I am a JD. And so here we go into the DJ business. A little more Cuban music on the Savage Nation. Come on. Now, can you get another tune other than the same one? I don't happen to like female vocalists in Cuban music. There was one great lady who did it, but she had a voice. Ah, now you're talking about it. Guajira is good. Imagine Sarah Palin running for president. I'd leave the country. That's the best the Republicans could do. I'm out of here. I'll move to Hungary. I'll open up a barbershop. Ah, vaya, 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 amigos. Maybe I'll go to Uruguay. Open a reptile shop. Maybe Paraguay, I can open a fruit stand in Paraguay. All else there. I have nightmares about what's coming in this country. I'm selling ices in Paraguay. Things go bad after what I've achieved in America. I have to flee to Paraguay. Listen to this voice. I can't explain it, but I'm not going to bother. Play it for a minute. I'll kill the audience. They don't want to hear this.
Voy a hacerle la historia de mi vida.
He's telling a story through his singing, right? But this is when it's a simple story. It's always about love and loss, about a woman who had us. It's always about a woman. Something about the Latin men are always losing their girlfriends. I don't know what it was, the garlic breath, whatever. I don't know. They're always crying about losing a wife. They're such good lovers. What are the women always running away from them for? I never could figure it out. But the beautiful part is that when they told their stories through ballads, any great singer, there's a way to do it and another way to do it. I'm going to give you one word. Those of you who speak Spanish, you ready for the word? This man sings with a word called duende. D-U-E-N-D-E. Duende. There is no direct translation for the word duende. Duende. It means soul. This man has soul. So you can sing a ballad and not have soul. You can do a talk show without soul, and you wind up nowhere. Or you can be Michael Savage, where you have brains and soul. Vaya! Vaya! Vaya!
Más, la nación de Savage, solamente aquí.
Transports you to Tunisia in your mind, right? That's art. Every time I used to hear this as a kid, it would take me out of geometry, you know. That's why it was so subversive. It's like my father, why are you listening to that evil music? He knew, don't worry. He knew it would prevent me from becoming a dentist. Oh, whatever. I'd probably be dead by now. If I had actually become a dentist and played the accordion, dead already. 49 top, a blowout. 6 feet under. But, you know, there's a lot of fire in my blood. Must be some gypsy in my blood, too. Who knows? You know, you go to Europe, you think you know with the pogroms and the invasions and the villages and the fights and the swords. You know who what? 500 years ago went on into the gene pool. Whoever it was, man, I thank him for that wild gene. I've always been different than everyone. Oh, God. You try that. All right, anyway, I could play it all day, but that's Dizzy Gillespie, Night in Tunisia. Try that with your top down in a convertible on a quiet country road at night and see if the rabbits don't get scared. Now, let's play something. You want to hear something disorienting? Go from that now to Jackie Onassis's voice.
All three pictures in this room are by Healy. There's Thomas Jefferson, a copy after Stuart. And then there's Daniel Webster, who didn't live here, but he visited the White House for 40 years.
Now, Jackie Onassis Kennedy's voice is disorienting. It's an obvious girly act. I mean, come on, this girl was as smart as they come. You know, JFK, whatever. Frank Sinatra, allegedly, a few. And then Onassis, right, the toad-like Greek shipping magnate. But if you listen to a voice, it's like a Milltown Manhattan cabbie voice thrown in, like female Milltown Manhattan cabbie voice, right? You know, you didn't, right? Milltown Manhattan cabbie voice. I like when she says chiner, this chiner. I love that. When she's talking about a piece of pottery, she's this chiner. Now, if I said that, you'd say I'm illiterate. But Jackie Kennedy would say this chiner came from, you know, whatever. So it was high class because she was from Hyannis Port, and I was from the lowest port in the Bronx. So what do you want from me? Same accent. She's from the Hyannis Port. I'm from the low Hyannis Port. Whatever. What's the difference where you're from? I've told you that 1,000 times. It doesn't matter where you began. It matters where you end up. Have you figured that out yet? It doesn't matter how it begins for you. It matters how it ends for you. Because, I have to tell you what that means. How many people start with everything and end up with nothing? And how many people start with nothing and end up with a lot? Now, but there's a thing that comes out of the ancient wisdom that says a man can spend his entire life building his reputation and in one careless act destroy his entire reputation. We know that. You understand that, mister? You understand what that means? One careless act, meaning one mistake and you're done, particularly in our society. So, you know, life is like that. That's why I'm a fan of many different things. I love very skilled performers, but I also love, for example, martial arts. I'm not a martial artist. Mentally, I may be as adept as anyone you've ever met, but physically, it's a whole different world. These people can take punishment. It doesn't matter what their size is. There are people in the fighting professions that are built differently than you and I, and I have met them in my life. There's a different DNA code, and they can take punishment in ways you can't imagine. But the fact is not only can they take abuse, they can give abuse. However, the fact of the matter is you have to desire to do that with your body. And it doesn't mean that everyone who does it is a dummy either. Don't make that mistake. Don't assume everyone who's boxing or fighting is stupid. Please don't make that error. It's the same thing as saying everyone who's a professor is smart, okay? It's the reverse of that, you know, quotient. So you have to, you know, see the individual. I forgot already the train of thought. It's a sad thing. That's why, because I listened to Jackie. I have a headache today. I'll tell you exactly what happened. After last night's show, I had the sore throat. I drank scotch for the sore throat, I told you. Luckily, the sore throat went away. It resolved. I have a smashing headache, though. See, that's the problem. That's life. Beautiful. Every day is another struggle. It's an awful thing. I think I'm going to take a vow of silence and join a monastery. The problem is I don't like monks. I never met a monk I liked. I met a few. You think I never met a monk? You're wrong. In Mill Valley, California, if you go over a hill, there's a Zen monastery called the Green Gulch. I don't know all of them, nor can I generalize. Every time I've gone to a certain, like an English inn that they built down there on the other side of the valley, the monks go over there. They're like bald heads with cassocks they wear, drunks. They drink like fish. And they're all, you know, loud, loudy kind of. They're basically the normal guys in a frock picking organic vegetables. I don't get that whole thing. Why do they have to do that? I mean, that's their business. You know, I said there's billions of people, there's millions of ways to live. Everyone has their own way through life. Monk. I never met a monk, really. A nice monk. Why does everyone as a monk have to be saintly? A lot of the guys aren't saintly. That's why they become monks. I mean, figure out their whack jobs to go into that later on in life. Who would do that if they were having a decent life, even some troubles? They have to have troubles that you can't believe that even rehab doesn't work. The only thing left for them is to take the cloth. I better not go to that drinking establishment again. There's like darts in there and bad warm beer. I like to go there in the winter when there's no tourists. I have beer and play darts. You ever play darts? And you talk about the queen. You talk about free association. You think the queen has a dartboard somewhere in her bedroom? Hey, Beowulf, does she live with a guy that is that Prince Philip? I don't know if I liked him or not. Wasn't he a Nazi? No, it was an uncle that was a Hitlerite, right? Yeah. They all have the guys with the big teeth. They remind me of, I don't know, something. They're connected to the Kennedys, the ones with the big teeth over there in England. Somehow, even though Irish, English, it's the large teeth that link them up. In my mind, I said. I didn't say they're actually directly linear related in any genetic sense. But, you know, so Michelle touches a big deal, gives her a hug. You think Prince Philip did her in the last 59 years? You must be joking. They live in two different castles. They have two different zip codes over there. They haven't seen each other probably for 43 years, except at functions where they serve, you know, dried codfish. So I'm sure that she loved having Michelle give her a hug. She said, wow, that's what a human being's touch feels like? Man, it's different than the Yorkie I've been touching. Ooh, sure feels different than touching a Yorkie. Not bad, man. As I say, better keep an eye on that queen after this touch, because if she starts doing drive-thrus through Brixton, you know, anything might happen. In San Francisco on the home station, KNEW, James, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Dr. Savage, what I'm hearing from you that really troubles me is this is beyond, you've gone beyond, way beyond sour grapes from just losing an election. And what you're saying is reactionary, it's slander, and it's un-American.
Okay, and, let's start with you. What did I say that's un-American?
Well, you're attacking President Obama before he's even had a chance. He won in the
Hey, schmuck. Schmuck! Schmuck, listen to me. I'm not your weak father. I'm Michael Savage. Let me tell you like it is, schmuck. Obama has jammed through a $1 trillion spending bill. It doesn't matter whether it was done in 1 week or in 4 years. Don't tell me I have to wait 100 days. If I wait 100 days, there'll be no country left.
He's doing what he was elected to do.
He was not elected to rob the Treasury. Didn't this man say he would not appoint lobbyists?
The people are sick of not...
Wait a minute. Shut up. Shut your mouth. Do you understand that you are an idiot? You're the dupe that he wanted. You're the chinless wonders that elected him. This man said he wanted change. This man said there would be no lobbyists.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of the Savage Nation.
For the first time in my adult lifetime, I'm really proud of my country.
These two are on loan from the Boston Museum of Fine Art. All three pictures in this room are by Healy. There's Thomas Jefferson, a copy after Stuart. And then there's Daniel Webster, who didn't live here, but he visited the White House for 40 years. And then the most famous one of all, is this one of Abraham Lincoln, which traditionally always hung in the state dining room. Healy was a contemporary of Lincoln, but he only saw him once, so he painted this picture from photographs.
See, now that was a first lady who was imbued with the history of the United States of America and proud to speak about it. Being facetious, I'm not being facetious. You know where I stand on this whole issue. Putting aside skin color, do you think Michelle Obama has the class of Jackie Kennedy? And I want no racial discussion. The fact of the matter is, there are comparisons that could be made. After all, Michelle is no, you know, slouch. She did go to Princeton. And while Jackie went to Vassar and GWU, Michelle did go to Princeton, okay? But as I said, Jackie Kennedy was raised to be a socialite, while Michelle Obama was raised to be an anti-socialite socialist. And while Jackie Kennedy was wooed by foreign dignitaries, so far as I can see, Michelle Obama has been booed by foreign protesters. So, you know, you decide. You know, when they were alive, the Kennedys, they were living in another world. It was a world, as I said to you before, where when the chrome was thick and the women were straight, sure. But it was also a world when liberals like her husband, JFK, had the guts to stand up to foreign tyrants, which I don't see happening thus far from this band of progressives. And it was a world where women were respected, even if they didn't stand up and give speeches to gay and lesbian groups and anarchist groups, as Michelle Obama has done. So I, you know, you can compare and contrast, but I'm not very impressed with Michelle thus far. 1-800-449-8255. You do know that Bernie's boat goes bye-bye. The bull was confiscated in Florida. The truth is, though, you know, used yachts today are near worthless. You can just imagine what that pig is worth. It's all a window dressing. You know, the government seizing Bernie Madoff's boats, big deal, window dressing. Why don't they seize his apartment? And why don't they seize Ruthie's jewels and assets and the boys Mark and Andrew and the grandchildren, their assets? You know, forget the window dressing, typical government window dressing. Recently, I was in South Florida, by the way, speaking of Bernie Madoff and speaking of boats. And I went into an antique store, used furniture, used this. I told you my dad was in a business, so once in a while I love to go into a consignment shops. You don't know what you're going to find, particularly in South Florida today. You can find anything. It was mainly dreck, you know. It's sad you go in those stores, you see tables and chairs that your grandmother must have had. They look like funeral home, you know, like, ugh, you know, sad. You could see they had candy on it and that kind of thing. I don't mean they're bad people, but I found something you're never going to believe, which I bought and brought home to my studio. It's a life ring from the British warship, the HMS Sheffield. Now, it looks like an original. I mean, I'm not going to ask the antique guy if it's original. What do they know? It looks to me like it is because it's not plastic, and it's an original life ring from the British ship HMS Sheffield. And this is interesting. Would you stop ringing in here? Interesting. In the studio, ringing, dinging, things going on, like around the clock. So I bought the HMS Sheffield Life Ring. I paid very little money for it. And then I bought a wooden wheel from an old ship. I know I can tell it's an old ship wheel, not a repro. I put it in my studio. My studios look like old bars in North Beach used to look. Artifacts, things hanging from the ceiling, from the walls, on the floor. It's a place that's, you know, it reflects my interest. So does anyone know who sank the HMS Sheffield and when? Whoever does wins a free copy of Psychological Nudity when it is available. Right now we're sold out. We're taking back orders. Would you believe I went through the second printing without anybody appearing on Oprah Winfrey or Good Morning America? And I'm going to print another edition. It's actually being printed. But if you want a copy, you have to do a back order. If anybody knows who sank the HMS Sheffield and when, and you can get on the show and do it, 1-800-449-8255. You know, it's interesting. I'll tell you why it's interesting. Then I ate in a Cuban restaurant recently in South Florida. I got to tell you something. So I go in this Cuban restaurant, small family joint. I had a piece of grouper fish broiled. I had plantain. They have a sweet one. I said, make it regular. Wait, it gets better. The rice, the beans. And the beans are much better than in the Mexican restaurants. I'm sorry to tell you. I don't know what it is, but the Cubans do it better. In the dish, a plate of garlic, chopped garlic. I didn't have to ask for it like it was some secret, bomb. And chopped onions. I thought I found my homeland. But you know what struck me the most about this Cuban restaurant was a poster that the guy had in the window. It said, Family History. And it shows a picture of the whole family, all the girls, all the boys, grandmother and grandfather. And listen to what it says on the bottom. Our deepest gratitude to our loyal customers and this beautiful country for allowing our family to pursue our dreams. So I had to go up to the owner. And I said to him, you have a beautiful family and a beautiful family story. And I got to tell you something. It's nice to see. I said, compared to so many of the immigrants who come in today who have the wrong attitude. He said, you're 100% right about that. Now, here's something interesting. In the family history, it says Mariel Boatlift, 1980, 126,000 Cubans abandoned their communist island in a massive exodus. And this family was one of the families. What you don't know is that the communists and the American media made you think that all of the Mariel Boatlift Cubans were criminals. But 99.9% of them were decent Cubans who lost their businesses, lost their homes to the son of a gun murderer, Castro, the Castro killers. And it is true that Fidel Castro, to poison the well of the decent Cubans who fled the island in 1980, to poison the well and make Americans think all the Mariel boat people were criminals. He threw criminals out of the prisons so that everyone in America would say they're all drug dealers. You have no idea how powerful the communist lobby is in the American media. You think everyone from the Mariel Boatlift was a drug dealer. 99.99% were people like you who are terrified of what's coming to this country. And if you think Castro was not related to Obama politically, you are mistaken. Our deepest gratitude to our loyal customers in this beautiful country, it says, for allowing our family to pursue our dreams. What a beautiful, beautiful thing that is, huh? Anyway, that's the difference here. Do we have a winner yet? Bingo! I think we have a winner on the Savage Nation. He's actually wrong. Dave in Norfolk, Virginia, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yeah, wasn't the Bismarck and the beginning of World War II?
Well, I'm not certain if that was... Are you saying there was an original Sheffield and a copy?
Well, the HMS Bismarck, Sheffield, was one of the first ships sunk by the Bismarck, I believe.
Well, the actual Sheffield that I am thinking of was the 1982 British ship when the HMS Sheffield was hit by an Argentine missile fired from a fighter bomber.
Right, I'm saying I may be thinking of the wrong...
Think you're thinking of the HMS Hood that was sunk by the Bismarck and went down with almost all men aboard.
Yeah,
I made the same. When I bought this life ring in the antique store, I thought of the Hood also till I said, wait a minute, what am I talking about? It wasn't that, but thanks for the call. I made the same mistake. And it makes sense because I bought the life ring in South Florida, and I said, wait a minute. It must have come from someone from Argentina who picked up the Sheffield's life ring when it sank, you know, in the islands down there. In the Falklands Islands, and then sold it to, who knows, to an antique bum, and the antique this, that. Yes, no, we have the winner already. No more calls in it. That way I save a free copy of the book. The HMS Sheffield was a British ship sunk in 1982 by an Argentine missile fired from a fighter bomber. and I have the life ring from it. How much do I hear for this life ring? How much do I have? Do I have $50? Do I have $50? One of these days I'll auction off all of the flotsam and jetsam that I bought around the world and raise it for a good cause, but not today. I'm keeping it. I love it. But if you want to talk about the media and Michelle Obama, you can call me at 1-800-449-8255. And if you think this is going to be a light show and you're not going to get agitated, you may be wrong. London, England, celebrity chef Jamie Oliver, yeah, right, will serve a dinner of Scottish organic salmon, woo, that's rare, Welsh lamb, and a traditional Bakewell tart for G20 leaders. Now, we don't know if the Bakewell tart is a lady from one of the side streets for the leaders, but I don't know, I never heard of a Bakewell tart. Traditional ingredients and recipes inspired from England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and the Channel Islands for the dinner at 10 Downing Street. Oliver will cook the meal along with a team of young chefs from the Apprentice program at his London restaurant. Because some guests have special dietary requirements, Oliver said he'll be offering vegetarian options. Isn't that touching? Oh, that must be the Obama people. They don't want to eat an actual salmon. Baked Scottish salmon with seashore vegetables, broad beans, herb garden salad, mayonnaise and wild garlic-scented Irish soda bread. I hate soda bread. I had it in an Irish pub once. I don't know what the big deal is. Full of butter and cream. Yuck. Very high rate of heart attack in Ireland. Vegetarian option. Chilled Wickbury goat's cheese with roast shallots, seashore vegetables, herb green salad, and wild garlic-scented Irish soda bread. No mayo. Ooh. Oh, for the real, the runner. Run. Look at the watch. Dead at 33. Give me the media. I'll live to 59, 60. Compared to the... No bread, no mayo, no butter, no meat. They think they're going to live forever. They're going to beat the clock. Slow-roasted shoulder of Welsh lamb, very first of the season, Jersey Royals. That's a potato, by the way. First of the season, asparagus and wild St. George mushrooms. Mint sauce and gravy. Vegetarian option, lavash and potato dumplings with first of the season asparagus and wild St. George mushrooms. Hot Bakewell tart, we'll leave that alone again. We had already did the Hot Well tart, a joke already. Blah, blah, blah. That's it. They're always bland. It's not my kind of food. I like the Cuban restaurant today better. A grouper. I like broiled grouper, rice and beans. And, oh, man, the garlic on that. Why don't they eat garlic, these guys? Maybe it would save the world if they all ate some garlic and talk to each other with a little garlic breath after it. You know, like human beings. I got to go to dinner after the show tonight. I got a menu here from a new restaurant someone sent me. Look at this stuff in this. Asian chicken spring rolls. It looks to me like the chicken was probably alive when Mao Zedong was a grandfather. Flash fried calamari. That means, yeah, they beat it to death in China somewhere, froze it, then unfroze it, defrosted, frozen, and then the runs. Oyster shooter. Who would go in a restaurant and say, give me an oyster shooter? It sounds like they're a dirty thing to order. Oyster shooter. I never heard it. Why can't they just say what you're eating? Here's like something that mahi veracruzana. I can understand. Grilled fresh Florida mahi, tomato, calamata, olive, caper, and lime. That I understand. What's with an oyster shooter? Tilapia. That's like pond grown. That's the worst. Tilapia. Never eat that. Never eat. Grilled Scottish salmon. That would be for Madoff. That would be for Madoff. Scottish salmon served with roasted vegetable ratatouille. Tutui. Chilean sea bass. I don't like Chilean sea bass. It must be I don't even like Alaskan sea bass. It's too white fishy for me. It's like falls apart like as a fish. It's a fish that should leave it alone already. Filet mignon, never touch the stuff. Chicago ribeye, New York strip, frog legs. That's sad. Only the French could find some. Frog legs, I don't know. How could you not feel bad for the frog when you eat that? Well, I understand. So you eat a chicken, it's the same thing. But lately, I can't even eat a chicken. I'll tell you why. My dog is only 11 pounds. What's shocking to me is that my dog's, like, hindquarter, I looked at it the other day when he got wet and I looked at his leg. It looked like a large chicken leg. I got frightened. So I said, how could you eat a chicken and savor it? And the dog's, I can't do it. And I say, then your mind starts running. If you have a kaleidoscopic mind like I do, like what if you were starving, would you eat Teddy? Don't even think about it. I mean, you think about it. Would you roast him? How would you eat? Stop it. Your mind starts working on you. You know, you're starving. It's you and Teddy. When are you going to die anyway? Would you roast him? Would you cook him? Would you eat him? Would you eat him raw? Oh, stop it, man. But your mind starts going there. Am I the only one who thinks this way? Savage. Portland, Oregon, KXL. Michael, welcome. What's on your mind?
Yeah, Dr. Savage, I am a leftist, and I disagree with virtually everything you say. But the reason I listen to you on talk radio is because your arguments are articulate, well thought out, and I think most importantly, sincere. I really appreciate it that you don't just regurgitate the sound bites from the Republican Party. And I think
no, I don't. But you see, look, I understand that I'm not going to convince you to believe in what I say or believe in my way, but I know also that most, let us say, sincere activists on the other side are just as frightened of an overbearing government as am I. Would you say that that's true? Can we agree on that?
Absolutely.
All right. So the day they take away my freedom of expression, you're next. Then you understand that as well. You do or you don't?
No, I do agree. Absolutely.
No, I would if I were a left winger. What do you think? You'd celebrate the ending of talk radio today. You'd be next tomorrow on the internet. And that's why they stopped attacking the golfer, because it was backfiring on the Obama minions. Their own party was saying enough is enough.
Well, I think you're the gadfly to the party on the left. I mean, I think it's really important. I mean, you know, Socrates would agree. We need people like you to make our positions more honed and more intelligent on this side.
Well, you need people like me in order to make certain that the drink that you're preparing for me is of the proper potency. Well, look, I was young once and foolish and thought that the left-wing way had some truth. I was once a youngster, and you get older, you start to see things differently. But I would bet, Michael, that you had somebody or have somebody in your family along the lines of Michael Savage.
Family is, I would even say they're probably libertarians, but they don't subscribe to a particular party.
Right, but you're young. Are you still young, or are you over 40?
I'm 29.
Well, you're still young. Most young people tend to tilt toward the left, and they voted for Obama because they didn't want the old ways, and they didn't want McCain because they knew he was a continuation of Bush, and I felt the same way. But you can't really sit there, Michael, and I'm not here to pick an argument with you. You've been nice enough that you don't think Obama lied to you. You can't really believe that.
I voted for Obama. I have felt betrayed by Obama, especially my primary reason for voting for him was he was promising to withdraw the troops from Iraq, and now he's talking about keeping them there. So, especially with that, if
no, listen. When it happened, remember 2 weeks ago, I said I'm shocked he's moving the troops from Iraq to Afghanistan. But what? That's going to be a war that the left agrees with?
Right.
It's like a shell game here. You got to ask yourself, what's in it for the Democrats that they want troops in Afghanistan? Let us put aside any security considerations for the moment and be very cynical together. I kept criticizing Bush and hammering him because I was saying it was all about contracts at a certain point. And I was relentless on this contract business in Iraq. You know that if you listen to the show. Now, I suspect that the same thing is going to go on in Afghanistan. When I heard from a returning Iraq veteran that meals, which in the past had been prepared by Army cooks, in other words, an enlisted guy would be a cook, another would be a tailor, another would work in the laundry. I heard that a division of Halliburton was providing the meals, and every time a guy lined up for a meal, the government was billed $16. And if he went back for refills, they got billed $16 again. It confirmed my worst suspicions, Michael.
Well, you look for who benefits. Yeah, I don't see a clear benefit to the American people for staying in that unwinnable war.
So, but what do you feel about Obama saying that while he's against the earmarks, he's for them?
Well, like you said, it is double talk. It's new speak, and it confirms my worst fears. I got to admit, I was...
Uh-oh, you're in trouble, Michael. I hope your friends are not listening to this interchange. You're going to lose some friends after this.
I don't think so. I think most of my friends feel the same way. We were counting on them for actual change, and sending troops to Afghanistan, just like you
no,
said.
No, but it's not only business as usual. It's worse than business as usual. How do you guys feel about... You're younger than me by many decades. How do you feel about you're inheriting a budget mess that you'll never pay off? What do you think is going to happen to you when you're 50?
I doubt there'll be as many as entitlements as there are now. That's for certain. I'm afraid of how Social Security is going to collapse.
Well, let me ask you, as a young leftist who's honest enough to have a discussion with me without screaming and yelling, how do you feel about illegal aliens getting jobs in the so-called Porculus bill? Doesn't that bother you?
Well, yeah, I'm not a leftist in the sense that I think we should open our borders and teach everyone Spanish. I'm a leftist more on social issues, more just on personal freedoms. But as far as the illegal aliens...
Well, it sounds like you're more of a libertarian in that regard.
Yeah, if it's so...
Warning, the Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. Listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Jumping with my boy, see it in the city. Jumping with my boy, see it in the city. Mr. President of the DJ committee. We're gonna be up all night getting witty. We want you to spin the sounds by the witty. From down in the land that's real, real pretty. Make everything go real crazy over Jay-Z. Make everything go real crazy over Jay-Z. Play anything cool for me and my baby. We don't wanna think we're listening to lazy. It's got to be press, bird cheering all the bassy. The dial is all set right close to 80. Let her roll.
Listen to this. Oh my God, come on, listen to this saxophone. This is Symphony Sid, King Pleasure. This is not Symphony Sid, the DJ, the great jazz DJ. It's about him. What an honor that was. It's King Pleasure doing the thing. Doing the thing. So what I'm saying is, if I tell you these are my worldviews, it is because I come from another age, another time. This is the way I look at the world. Now you may say, okay, I can relate to it. Or you may say, I don't relate to it. I'm from another generation. I look at it differently. And I'm not asking for your yeses or your noes here. I'm just telling you where I'm coming from. And part of where I am coming from is explained by my taste in music, for example, even my taste in jazz. I never rarely play classical music, but trust me, I could do that. I do a lot of rock and roll Friday. Maybe I could do a jazz Thursday or whatever, but today's been a lot of jazz because we are doing it. And so I'm doing like something somebody sent me from the internet called High School 1959 versus 2009. But remember, I'm from another time, another place. So you say, well, it's Neanderthal times. Well, let me tell you something, man. I'm glad to be a Neanderthal. Because I don't like the world that I've been drug into by these pinheaded, fraudulent, neo-Marxist phonies who really don't want to do good. They want to control everybody's life from cradle to grave. They want to equalize income around the world, take from those who earn and give it to those who don't, and I will fight it every step of the way. So play a little A-Train by Duke Ellington on the Savage Nation. Because I rode the A-Train in order to get to the Z-Train. I started on the A train. I rode the E train. I wore the ugly raincoat. I worked the horrible jobs. I didn't have a you-know-what to pee in. I'm on the Z train, man. You try to take it away from me. You didn't give it to me. No slaves gave it to me. My grandfather was a slave in the sweatshops of New York. So don't give me any more of that liberal double talk that your ancestors were a slave and I owe it to you. I don't owe you garbage. And I speak for most of America. So when I hear Obama getting up there today in the Queen's England and coming up with this rubbish that we got to take care of, that we shouldn't run away from the world's poor, we are the most generous nation on earth. Where's he coming up with, like, we're a bad nation all of a sudden? Again, he and his wife are good. Everybody before him was bad. You know, they gave away $1 trillion now to the developing nations again. And they won't disclose, by the way. See, I didn't want to do this. They say that the G20 leaders have agreed to give $1 trillion to struggling nations. Oh, really? Which nations are giving how much? That they didn't disclose. I can guarantee you this. All George Soros, the puppet master who put this president in place, in my opinion, is not going to lose a penny on that $1 trillion. That I can guarantee you, okay? And you can put that into your pipe and smoke it along with your keef. So Symphony Sid, just before I finished on this, if you never heard of him, because he's been dead since 84, Symphony Sid was a Jewish guy from the Lower East Side, and he was just basically a jazz and Latin music disc jockey that everyone understood was the greatest disc jockey of all time, probably. And probably even greater than the Balloon Man, who no one ever heard of since he went to the scam artists on the satellite broadcasting network. But I read that Symphony Sid went to New York City in 1956. Late in life, he lived in Florida, where he enjoyed the pursuit of fishing. He died September 14th, 1984. I don't know how he could enjoy fishing. How could you go from being like a jazz, Latin jazz guy, jazz and Latin music, you know, rhythm and blues, one of the best-known disc jockeys in the world. He introduced rock and roll to rock people to rock and roll who never heard of rock and roll. And, you know, he knew everybody in the jazz business, and they loved him. He used to broadcast from Birdland over WJZ. Imagine that. He was arrested and given a suspended for having marijuana in his apartment. All right, in those days, they'd have marijuana. If you're in jazz, you'd have dope with the musicians. They all had to do that. I don't understand that, but okay, everyone had to do that. And Charlie Parker, you know, you name, you mentioned those names. He's involved with that Birdland. You say Birdland, Bop City, Royal Roost. You say 52nd Street Jazz Clubs. All gone with the wind except for the people who remember jazz. You understand who Symphony Sid was. No one knows who he is today. But what I'm saying, the guy was amazing. His voice was astonishing on the air. Now, why am I telling you this? I don't know what his politics were. If he was a pot-smoking Jewish guy for the Lower East Side, guaranteed communist, unionist. That I can guarantee. I don't care what his politics were. It doesn't matter to me. All I know is that the guy had a mellifluous voice. And when I was coming home after a hard day in the anatomy lab, studying memorizing the entrails of a pig in Latin, in high school or in early college, you know, with smelling the formaldehyde in the refrigerator mixed in with my mother's gefilte fish. Did I ever tell you that story when I put the pig in the refrigerator? You never heard that story when my aunt found the pig in the refrigerator. You got to hear that story one of these days. I don't have the time for it. After a hard day of formaldehyde and pig's entrails in Latin memory, whatever, or a cat skeleton in a box, where I'm memorizing the names of the cat skeleton and anatomy. This is an undergraduate school, mind you. This is what you would imagine in my day, if you went to college and you took biology as a major, you had to, like, remember all the parts of a disarticulated cat skeleton, or you'd get a D, and they throw you get an F in anatomy, and then you have to take a pig home and learn all of its parts in Latin. You know what they have to do today to get an A and go on to Yale or Harvard? I can just imagine. You have to praise the Obamaites for what they've done for the poor of the world, I would suppose, and teach youngsters how to put a condom on a plantain, let alone a cucumber. Because in my, you know, just a few years ago, it was a plantain and a cucumber passed for muster. Today, no more with the third world invasion. They have to teach them how to put a plantain on a, they have to put a condom on a plantain, never mind. Let her roll. Let her roll. So there we were. But I'm going back to Symphony Sid now. I don't want to get off track here. Symphony sits on, now, day, nights, now it's nighttime. Anatomy, pig, formaldehyde, your head's bursting, migraineville. How am I going to remember all this garbage? It's Friday night. Please let me out of here because tomorrow I got to work with Dad, which is another prize coming tomorrow after 5 days of the school. What a lovely idea that is, going with him over the Kosciuszko Bridge into DeSoto with no music and going into the basement to clean things. I love that. And all the other boys are learning how to play tennis and ski. I like that, you know. Even though they were in the new world, I still was in the old world. Not only was I in the old world, but I was in Charles Dickens' old world, let alone the old world. I wasn't even the old world of my father's father. I was in the old world of Charles Dickens. So we go to the Palladium, And we listened mainly to Latin music. At that time, that was the most phenomenal change, and it got you out of yourself. If you could listen to some of the Cuban musicians of that time, now there were some fabulous jumping Puerto Rican musicians. I came to love Panamanian music, by the way, which I found to be great at the time. But the best was the music that was coming out of Cuba. There was no question about it. We're talking 50s. We're talking late 50s, early 60s. Cuban music, as it was played in New York City, one of the great times in the history of the world for music. People love that music before it got polluted by some guy. I mean, trying to reintroduce it with that thing, but he put a guitar into it, like a twangy Hawaiian guitar. I never understood that. Remember he did the Hawaiian thing, he went to Cuba, and he did the Cuban All-Stars. That was amazing, but then he had to ruin it, the filmmaker, with his guitar. What was that all about? The twangy Don Ho thing he threw in there, wrecked everything. But we heard it in the Purista, the Puro, El Puro, you know. You got any Cuban music, so they know what I'm talking about, which I did a little bit of... No, don't like it. It's too jumpy, too dancey. Give me something with Duende, which I described the other day. Even though we're talking to crackers in Montana. No, I don't like female vocalists. I don't like them generally. I like macho singers, I gotta tell you right now. That's it. I wanna hear the vibration of the man's, you know. Is this Sonora Matancera? Who is this? I don't know right now. I don't know. The song is called Guajira. Okay, now, if you saw Godfather 2, remember when they take him to that club with the Cuban Superman with the large, and the senator gets excited, and he says, I want a redhead, and he says, con gusto, you'll have that, blah, blah, blah. And then the senator turns to Michael Corleone, the weak brother, whatever his name was, Frito, and he says, how did you find this place, Frito? They're all excited looking at the Cuban Superman turning around with the cape. And he says, oh, old man, whatever, Johnny took me here. Old man, whatever, the Jewish guy, Maya Lansky, wouldn't come here, but old Johnny, he knows his way around these places. Camera moves on Al Pacino's character, Michael Corleone. His face turns white. He realizes that his brother stabbed him in the back. Okay? That's what we're talking about. They understood the music. So now picture that band on the stage, like 32 pieces, feathers on the girls. They produce music like that today under communism? You must be joking. The girls are selling themselves for Coca-Cola in Castro's Cuba now. Tell me they had it worse under Batista. Cuba was better under Batista, you schmuck. Of course it was corrupt. Just like America was great when it was corrupt. You watch out for the do-gooder. All I can warn you is the purest of do-gooder will put you on a road to hell faster than any gangster ever will. That's all I can promise you. Because Michael knows the world. See, the smart gangster understands that in order to survive, he's got to leave something for the society to have. He can't take it all. It's a new age now. Now they want the whole world, they want to suck it through their horn, and wind up with nothing left. They don't even understand the whole balance. So you go back to the age of Batista. I'm not glorifying it. There was poverty there, right? Oh, there's no poverty in Cuba now. Oh, they all got health care. Health care, that's all they sold. When the Castro brothers came to town, if they stole everything from the middle class, everyone had health care. But when they need health care, they get a Jewish doctor from Miami flown in disguise, in mufti. They don't go to a Cuban doctor from the University of Havana who has a dirty bib on with a stethoscope that they could stab to death with the pieces falling off. You know, Castro himself, like 2 years ago, remember when he was near death? Looked horrible. Finally, after all those cigars, I said, he's mortal after all. Why are these SOBs? They live forever. The guy went on and on, giving 10-hour speeches every night. All the women of Cuba, they had to, like, submit to him. I don't know how the guy did it. 20 cigars a night, women, coffee, rum. You don't understand because the devil lives forever, okay? So he gets sick as a dog. He looks like he's on death's door. He went to a Cuban doctor? No, he got a doctor from Spain. Again, probably a Marano. His grandfather was probably, again, a Jewish from fled, you know, during the Middle Ages. He was a Marano and became a Catholic. All right, who else is he going to go to? He's going to go to one of the doctors from his fecocked medical school, the University of Havana? You would go there? What, are you kidding me? That's why it was a joke inside The Godfather when the Maya Lansky character's dying and they bring in the doctor who tells him in Spanish what's wrong. He says, I don't trust anyone who can't speak English. Fly my doctor in from Miami. I mean, come on, who wrote that stuff? Mario Puzo. Unbelievable. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Van Jones is an anti-police radical activist from the gutters of the Bay Area. Van Jones has made his name by videotaping police as they have done their job or try to do their job. Using video cameras, lawsuits, and protests, this character, Van Jones, has fought to prevent the police from protecting the citizens of the Bay Area against the scum and dregs of society. He has had policemen fired. He has ruined lives. And he's made us all more vulnerable to street gangs. And yet, strangely enough, or shall we say, predictably enough, Barack Hussein Obama has appointed this character, this anti-police character, Van Jones, who you're not going to read about tomorrow, to be Obama's special advisor on green jobs. What you don't understand is that this is a very dangerous appointment. Why are there so many czars under Obama, number one, who bypass the normal appointment process, who are not grilled by senators or congressmen, who report only to Obama? The reason is it's a power grab. Now, I want to tell you something else that you have to know. The fact of the matter is that Obama may be getting ready to organize his own personal army, not of brown shirts, but of green shirts. And that is why he has given this street thug, Van Jones, in my opinion, a street thug, a man who has specialized in harassing the police themselves, this all-important job. If Obama should appoint thousands or more than thousands of people to the environmental green czar to work for him, and then he deputizes them and then gives them guns and then gives them federal powers over that of the local police, you will know that we are repeating history in the United States of America. You see, there was another man in another country who rose to power on an army of street thugs. And he had a friend named Ernst Röhm, who headed up an organization called the SA. The SA was a political army which protected the Nazi Party leadership. It battled political opponents and terrorized the German people who opposed Hitler. Ernst Röhm was an avowed socialist. He rejected capitalism. He pushed for the nationalization of German industry and the redistribution of wealth. It seems that the Obama appointees actually have almost the same exact policies as the Nazi Party did. What you don't know is that the environment in this case is being used by the Obama administration in an attempt to gain control of the U.S. population. The brown shirts, as I said, under Hitler, were used to intimidate Germans who opposed Hitler. My fear is that Obama will be using the green shirts, these street agitators, in order to control the police and the people. Now, you're not able to talk about this because the vermin in the media are covering up this very dangerous situation that is going on right in front of your nose.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
Shall I tell you the story of Love by the Sewer Plant? In order to do that, I have to set this up. Play the Shabub Shabub song. I only have eyes for you. I want to go back in time now. And I hope that the girl involved is not listening. I pray to God.
I can't see anyone but
you. We're talking Springland, not Springland. We're talking, I don't know the town anymore. We're talking Route 42. We're talking 56, 57. We're talking a sewer plant. We're talking about Love by the Sewer Plant. First Love by the Sewer Plant. Now, this girl was so beautiful that the, like, it was like summer stock. Turn that on. They can't listen to me in the music. They got the mood already. We said it. In other words, this is a small hotel, like, a, you know, nothing fancy. The owner was a former boxer, a pugilist. He was the one where I told you that Jackie, who worked at the hotel, got thrown in the pool. I don't remember the name of him. But he was a tough guy, this guy, genuinely tough guy. And that if he got into an argument with anyone who worked for me, beat them up and threw them off the property, that type. Everyone was terrified of him. Old school New York Jewish kind of street fighter type. So he ruled this little hotel that he had like with an iron thumb, an iron whatever, iron boot. He was a tough guy, and things ran right. Nothing ever went wrong. No one robbed cutlery. No one talked back. So anyway, I'm a kid. There's a kid there, and boom, it's loved by the sewer plant across down the thing in the river by the Neversink River. The water was so cold that when you waded across it, your feet turned blue. I'll tell love by the sewer plant, but starting with the shabup shabup again. Now I got time to tell it. Again, they can't find it.
Again, my love must be a kind of blind.
This is unbelievable. I lost my desire to talk already.
I can't see anyone but
on the
you.
Uptake, they're not. I got a migraine. Just clicked in. Whole right side of the head is out. Right, they don't understand this. How could the audience follow my brain? I got to make them follow. How? Explain to them. All right. Okay, turn it off now. It's 56-57, Plymouth Fury, 59. My uncle had a Plymouth Fury, I think. I'm not sure. Somewhere around then. Outside one of the hotels in the Catskill Mountains. I'm still young, 15. I don't know how old I was, something like that. So, fall in love, first love by the sewer plant. Here's how it is. This girl was so stunningly gorgeous, like just really beautiful, that the theater companies would come through. They had like an entertainment in these hotels, like they call it a casino. At night, they'd have entertainment. Sometimes they'd have a comedian who was terrible, a juggler, a balloon man, who then eventually the father of the guy who went on XM or Sirius. His father was a balloon man, allegedly, who went around making pornographic images with balloons, as the son does verbally. Things like that. In other words, schlocky entertainment. So, nevertheless, they thought they were artists. You got to understand that. Even though they were schlocky entertainment, let's say they could paint velvet paintings. They're still a painter. In their mind, they're Van Gogh. They were theatrical, and everyone else was bourgeois, you know. The other people ate the borscht, and they ate the chave. In other words, they were the artistes, so they understood. So, in other words, some of these entertainers came around, and they looked at this girl, and they came running up. I was holding her hand or walking with her. We were kids, and they said, Manny, I wanted you to see this girl. This is the girl I was telling you about. And they like looked at her like she was a specimen of, you know, like biblical beauty. So to make a long story short, it's just young love by the sewer plant. And what I meant was, where are you going to go when you're a kid? You got nowhere to go. So we took a walk down the hill, down the hill, down the hill, down the hill, down the hill. Jack and Jill went down the hill. And it was a long slope down to the Neversink River. And there was a sewer treatment plant, which occasionally, as you well know, with sewer treatment plants, they're not exactly, they don't smell that good. But kids don't care. They can override anything, particularly when the lust hits them. So the two kids walk down the hill. They cross the river, and their feet, they roll up the dungarees, take off the shoes. The legs are blue. And they have a little moment of passion together. And it was his first moment of passion. It was not exactly on the level of a complete moment of passion, but for him, it was the first of that type. So now the kid is starstruck and walked like stars in his eyes after that. There were not enough stars in the sky that night in the black sky and the billions of stars to equal the passion that he had for the world, where he thought he could literally reach out, grab a star, and fly away. That's how phenomenal he felt as a youngster. But then, of course, as you well know, nothing like that lasts. So what I'm getting at with the story is that it was by a sewer plant and there's nothing more to it, and boom, and now play some John Coltrane, because there's no more to the story that I care to tell, because if I do, it'll become a pantomime, and I don't want to embarrass myself with a pantomime of something that was quite beautiful. So why don't you play some John Coltrane so they'll understand why it ended that way. It just ends abruptly. Good jazz ends abruptly. In Florida, Robin, you're up on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
I agree with Reverend Wright. I'm a Jew. I'm
Wait. What is the connection between hating America and being Jewish? Is there something I'm missing here?
No, but okay. First of all, God's the only judge. Reverend Wright, when he's everything that America is founded on is Christianity, from Thanksgiving to Christmas to
And what should it be founded upon? Paganism?
No, I think it should be found upon the Old Testament and the truth. I mean, everything there.
Wait, you know, you're all over the map. It sounds like you're a mentally disturbed individual. You said you agree with Reverend Wright and you're a Jew. What do the two statements have to do with each other?
Okay, let's cut a tree down and celebrate Christmas. What's up with that?
Excuse me, what's up with what you just said? That's evil, cutting a tree down? Are you standing on a wooden floor?
Let's kill a tree and celebrate life.
I asked you, are you standing on a wooden floor?
No, I'm actually on my bed.
You're on your bed. What, are you disabled?
No, I'm not a bit disabled.
Do you live on a government check of some kind from evil America?
I've never taken anything from anybody.
What is it that makes you hate the country? Tell me what it is you hate. You hate Christians? Is that it?
No, I hate the government. I hate.
So you're a Christophobe, in other words. You hate Christians? You said you don't like the fact that the country's founded on Christianity. You said that.
I hate the fact that we go to other countries and tell them that there's something to believe in. People don't believe in things they can't see, then why do they believe in God? There's controversy. The New Testament...
So you believe in Reverend Wright because you're mentally deranged and unstable. That's what you just proven. Nothing that you've said makes sense, incidentally, lady. You're a very, very emotionally unstable individual, and everything you're saying is disconnected from... Each thing you say is disconnected from the thing before it. But what is amazing to me is you don't realize you're fostering anti-Semitism when you say, I believe in Reverend Wright, who says he hates America, and I'm a Jew. What does your Jewishness have to do with hating America? Can you explain that to me?
No, I'm a converted Jew, and hating America, like I told you, their foundation.
What do you mean? You're converted from what to whom?
Calm. You're going to be...
Robin, you're converted from what to what?
I'm just saying that America...
No, answer my question. You're converted from what to what?
I converted from a Baptist to a Jew.
And so now you speak for Jews?
I gave things up. I quit walking in sin. If I knew something...
I'm saying, so now you speak for Jews by hating America? Is that how you think you speak for Jews?
I don't hate anything. I disagree with America. I disagree with how you can get insurance on anybody without them even knowing. That's
oh, you're crazy. Okay, lady, have a nice day. Really, this is Creedmoor material. Wow, whew, I'm exhausted. I'm gonna need a Schwitz bath after this one. I need to go right into a Schwitz bath. Whew. I don't know how psychiatrists do it. You know, the more I listen to crazy people, I really don't know how someone does psychiatry. You got to go nuts after 8 of those a day. I remember when I was a kid trying to figure out what to do. The doctor, you know, was an authority figure. He came into the house to treat my father, who had a heart attack. He's a nice young guy, and he said, well, what do you want to be? I said, oh, I think I want to be a psychiatrist. He says to me, why in the heck would you want to sit and – he sat down with me. He said, why would you want to listen to people's troubles? Don't you realize that it's going to make you very unhappy? That was when I gave up psychiatry. I was still in high school. I do it anyway. Now I'm a psychiatrist for the nation. It's even worse. Mississippi, Anita, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, let me explain it to you guys who don't understand, like you're 4 years old. The man does not think he is a messiah. Picture the United States as the Titanic. It's sinking. He went down to the hole, to the Arabic nation, to put a plug in it, to stop the
Now, I realize that you don't have the education to finish a sentence with any degree of literacy, although you accuse others of being an infant. I would challenge you as to how far you went in school and what you've actually read. You are wrong. Obama has done his first formal TV interview, not with the American people on an American network, but with Al Arabiya to an Arabic audience. That should worry you.
What education do you have? Because you're talking to an educated woman just because I'm from Mississippi does not...
I understand that. Well, I have a PhD in... Listen, stop running at the mouth. I'm not one of your students. I have an earned PhD from the University of California at Berkeley and 2 master's degrees. I've written 25 books. Does that help you with the question?
Say it again?
I'm not going to say it again. What, are you too dumb to understand what I said? You didn't like what you heard?
It wasn't to pay off.
You didn't hear what I said. You didn't hear what I said, but you want to challenge me on an educational level. You're barking up the wrong tree, my friend. Okay? You can't hold a candle to my education. You don't know what you're talking about. The man has gone to the Arab street rather than to the American street. Why doesn't that worry you, Anita?
They left trash out, and that's to be expected. It's, you're going to have trash when you have 2.5 million people.
What, I'm sorry, what did you just say?
I said the Democrats who went to see him, the whites, the blacks, the Mexicans, and everybody else who went to see him in Washington, they did not trash Washington. Of course, they left some trash behind, but that's what you pay the...
No, I said they trashed the National Mall. That's an obvious reality.
Trash.
But you didn't read it in your local newspaper, did you? Because they don't want to make anything that Obama does negative. But you're getting off the track because you don't have a logical mind. You're going to make the audience follow you into your confusion. The issue is not trashing of Washington, which his followers did. The issue is that the man has given his first formal TV interview to the Arab street on an Arab network. Don't you think that's a question that people should be asking themselves as to why?
That's where the problem is, not to get paid back. The blacks who put him in office, the whites who put him in office, the Mexicans who put him in office, and everybody else who put him in office, they contribute dollars, 50 cents, a quarter to his campaign. It's something unprecedented, something that has...
But you're not answering the question. You're going off at the mouth without thinking. You don't know what you're talking about. I just ask you what that has to do with him giving his first formal TV interview as president with Al Arabiya rather than with an American network. It is unprecedented. Why would he have done that, Anita?
He gave his first formal interview to Robin Roberts.
You know, ma'am, I hope to God that you are not a teacher because I pity the poor students who have to put up with your illogic and your emotional outbreaks. You are not qualified to be a teacher. You're not even qualified to call a talk show.
Savage.
I don't like cutesy. I don't like people who talk to their children cutesy. It makes me squirm. You ever hear these parents talk to their children with, like, cute talk? That's why the child winds up a psycho. You know, I got to tell you a little trick about child rearing. In my opinion, one man's opinion, and I haven't done so bad. Speak to them as you would an adult, and they will grow up more intelligent, and they will be more competent younger. You ever listen to the people with the children? I love the ones who take them to a restaurant and give them a lesson in front of you to show how smart they are, how smart the child is with the pencils and the coloring book. You're spending $29 for a plate of spaghetti that costs 4 cents, and there they are next to you. The guy with the ponytail, he's 63, with a 30-year-old girl he met somewhere at a club. And right away, a year later, they have the baby. And 4 years later, ready the coloring book and the crayons in the pasta palace. And they're all set up. They got the whole thing. They got the backpack. They got the diaper at your next table. And they got the coloring book and the crayons, which should be outlawed in restaurants. It's not ding-dong school. Not everything is a ding-dong school. There was a time, and I raised children. I wasn't allowed in certain restaurants with the children when they were young. I didn't like it. But I understood it. People didn't want to be disturbed by children. Now, if they get sued, if they say to the people, you know what, we'd rather you not change doo-doo at the table, right away they call ACLU or a lawyer like an ACLU, or like a smarter one than an ACLU lawyer, the brother who went into private practice with the same mentality. Marvin goes into the ACLU because he's stupid, and Barry goes into the private practice and sues, but they're the same mentality, two heads of the same hydra. That's it, the coloring books in the restaurant. How do you spell Louisiana, Louise? Very good. And then the mother claps at the desk. Yeah, this is where you're sitting having a romantic meal. $29.95 for the pasta al ripoffo. Antipasto consisting of a piece of old rotten cheese from Brooklyn that they couldn't sell to the Italians in New York because they know better. So they ship it to San Francisco. That's $9.95 for one little piece of mozzarella cheese. And a tomato. They give it an Italian name. $9.95 with a tomato and one little piece of cheese that the Italians rejected on the wharf. Even the wharf rats rejected it, but they can sell it in San Francisco. And $29.95 for pasta al creato. I don't mind it, all right? Well, you're going in for the ambience. No one's there for the food. They're in for the ambience. But the coloring book is there right away. and the lessons you have to listen to. Do you ever hear these lessons at these tables? Does this go on in Louisiana or only in the major cities that you have to listen to these impossible parents? I never talk cute to the children. Okay, I'm a product of my upbringing. Harsh, Spartan-like. Don't be cute. I don't like cute. No jokes. Just get back to work. No matter what I did, I tried to entertain my friend. All right, get back to work. Stop the entertainment. He knew I was trying to, like, wiggle out of work by entertaining him. All right, that's very good. Now get back to it. No radio. On the way into work, I swear to God, if I was, like, driving in his car, I don't know how old I was. He didn't want the radio on. If I tried to put the radio on because it was horrible, sitting next to your father in a car on the way to work, it was going to be a horrible day in a disgusting market all day long, which I didn't want to do. I didn't want to go to begin with, but I didn't say anything. Okay, he needed me there. That was the way it was done. I didn't have any option anyway. It was like a little prison camp. But all right, so you sit in the right seat like a dummy, your hands folded on your lap, and nothing, not a word, mum. The whole ride. BQE, the Kosciuszko Bridge, the stink of the pork dying there, the Trun's Meat Market, where the eye goes out. You think that you ran over a skunk, but there are no skunks in Williamsburg. That packing plant in August was enough, Mike. You talk about a weapon of mass destruction. The Trun's Meat Packing Plant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, in the 50s, was a WMD. That's why rents were low in those days. The floors were cockeyed with linoleum that when a dog would urinate in the bedroom, would run into the living room because the floors were old. But that's the way it was. No one complained. Today you got the same losers who can't live in Manhattan. They live there now. They discovered the charm of Williamsburg. Oh, I really love it over here. It's really great. You know, it's right near the overpass, and I like the factory area. Nobody ever wanted to live there. Even when it was in its heyday, nobody wanted to live there. But the point I'm making is a little different. So if you sit in the car, you're next to your father driving to work, and you know you can't say anything. There's nothing to say. He's grim. He's white. His hands are white-knuckled on the wheel because he's gone in again another horrible day to make a living. Nothing was fun. Nobody worked in those days for fun. This was an evolution of the Dr. Spock generation. Find what's fun and pursue it. Pursue what's fun. To my father, nothing was fun. It was grim. Horrible. It was like Grimm's fairy tales. Came over, work, drop dead, and move on. It's in the ground. In the ground. That's it. Next case. Next generation. There was no fun. From another world, they didn't know what the word fun was. So he's driving to work. The hands are like white knuckles. And I'm sitting there. So my hand reaches, the left hand reaches for the radio dial, like to punch a button in. No radio. So what do you mean no radio? I don't want music. Why? Never mind why. This is not entertainment. It's work. So, all right. So work has to be torture. I get it. All right. That's why I'm in the radio business. I was made for this. What I'm getting at is he didn't like cute. If he saw people, and I'm the same way, unfortunately, I become him in essence. This is how it is. All the years I resisted becoming him, I came, a long time ago, I became my father. I admit it. There must be something to it. Worked for him. It's worked for me so far. Liberalism not only is a mental disorder, but destroys children.
Savage.